Chapter 2. I should say not, snorted the captain. 50 years boy and man on all the seas, and I've never seen it go down to that. Listen. They stood for a moment, while the surf rumbled and shook the house. Then they went outside. The squall had passed. They could see the Aurora lying becalmed a mile away, and pitching and tossing madly in the tremendous seas that rolled in stately procession down out of the northeast, and flung themselves furiously upon the coral shore. One of the sailors from the boat pointed at the mouth of the passage, and shook his head. Raoul looked and saw a white anarchy of foam and surge. I guess I'll stay with you tonight, Captain, he said. Then turned to the sailor, and told him to haul the boat out and to find shelter for himself and fellows. 29 flat, Captain Lynch reported, coming out from another look at the barometer, a chair in his hand. He sat down and stared at the spectacle of the sea. The sun came out, increasing the sultriness of the day, while the dead calm still held. The seas continued to increase in magnitude. What makes that sea is what gets me, Raoul muttered petulantly. There is no wind, yet look at it, look at that fellow there. Miles in length, carrying tens of thousands of tons in weight, its impact shook the frail atoll like an earthquake. Captain Lynch was startled. Gracious, he bellowed, half rising from his chair, then sinking back. But there is no wind, Raoul persisted. I could understand it, if there was wind along with it. You'll get the wind soon enough without worrying for it, was the grim reply. The two men sat on in silence. The sweat stood out on their skin in myriads of tiny drops that ran together, forming blotches of moisture, which, in turn, coalesced into rivulets that dripped to the ground. They panted for breath, the old man's efforts being especially painful. A sea swept up the beach, licking around the trunks of the coconuts and subsiding almost at their feet. Way past high water mark, Captain Lynch remarked, and I've been here 11 years. He looked at his watch. It is 3 o'clock. A man and woman, at their heels a motley following of brats and curs, trailed disconsolately by. They came to a halt beyond the house, and, after much irresolution, sat down in the sand. A few minutes later another family trailed in from the opposite direction, the men and women carrying a heterogeneous assortment of possessions. And soon several hundred persons of all ages and sexes were congregated about the captain's dwelling. He called to one new arrival, a woman with a nursing babe in her arms, and in answer received the information that her house had just been swept into the lagoon. This was the highest spot of land in miles, and already, in many places on either hand, the great seas were making a clean breach of the slender ring of the atoll, and surging into the lagoon. 20 miles around stretched the ring of the atoll, and in no place was it more than 50 fathoms wide. It was the height of the diving season, and from all the islands around, even as far as Tahiti, the natives had gathered. There are 1,200 men, women, and children here, said Captain Lynch. I wonder how many will be here tomorrow morning. But why don't it blow? That's what I want to know, Raoul demanded. Don't worry, young man, don't worry, you'll get your troubles fast enough. Even as Captain Lynch spoke, a great watery mass smote the atoll. The seawater churned about them 3 inches deep under the chairs. A low wail of fear went up from the many women. The children, with clasped hands, stared at the immense rollers and cried piteously. Chickens and cats, wading perturbedly in the water, as by common consent, with flight and scramble took refuge on the roof of the captain's house. A pomatan, with a litter of newborn puppies in a basket, climbed into a coconut tree, and 20 feet above the ground, made the basket fast. The mother floundered about in the water beneath, whining and yelping. And still the sun shone brightly, and the dead calm continued. They sat and watched the seas, and the insane pitching of the Arai. Captain Lynch gazed at the huge mountains of water sweeping in until he could gaze no more. He covered his face with his hands to shut out the sight, then went into the house. 2860, he said quietly when he returned. In his arm was a coil of small rope. He cut it into 2-fathom lengths, giving one to Raoul, and, retaining one for himself, distributed the remainder among the women with the advice to pick out a tree and climb. A light air began to blow out of the northeast, and the fan of it on his cheek seemed to cheer Raoul up. He could see the Aorai trimming her sheets and heading offshore, and he regretted that he was not on her. She would get away at any rate, but as for the atoll, AC breached across, almost sweeping him off his feet, and he selected a tree. Then he remembered the barometer, and ran back to the house. He encountered Captain Lynch on the same errand and together they went in. 2820, said the old mariner. It's going to be fair hell around here. What was that? The air seemed filled with the rush of something. The house quivered and vibrated, and they heard the thrumming of a mighty note of sound. The windows rattled. 2 panes crashed, a draft of wind tore in, striking them and making them stagger. The door opposite banged shut, shattering the latch. The white doorknob crumbled in fragments to the floor. The room's walls bulged like a gas balloon in the process of sudden inflation. Then came a new sound like the rattle of musketry, as the spray from AC struck the wall of the house. Captain Lindsay looked at his watch. It was 4 o'clock. He put on a coat of pilot cloth, unhooked the barometer, and stowed it away in a capacious pocket. Again AC struck the house, with a heavy thud, and the light building tilted, twisted, quarter around on its foundation, and sank down, its floor at an angle of 10 degrees. Raoul went out first. The wind caught him, and whirled him away. He noted that it had hauled around to the east. With a great effort he threw himself on the sand, crouching and holding his own. Captain Lynch, driven like a wisp of straw, sprawled over him. 2 of the Arai sailors, leaving a coconut tree to which they had been clinging, came to their aid, leaning against the wind at impossible angles, and fighting and clawing every inch of the way. The old man's joints were stiff, and he could not climb, so the sailors, by means of short ends of rope tied together, hoisted him up the trunk, a few feet at a time, till they could make him fast, at the top of the tree, 50 feet from the ground. Raoul passed his length of rope around the base of an adjacent tree and stood looking on. The wind was frightful. He had never dreamed it could blow so hard. A sea breached across the atoll, wetting him to the knees, ere it subsided into the lagoon. The sun had disappeared, and a lead-colored twilight settled down. A few drops of rain, driving horizontally, struck him. The impact was like that of lead and pellets. A splash of salt spray struck his face. It was like the slap of a man's hand. His cheeks stung, and involuntary tears of pain were in his smarting eyes. Several hundred natives had taken to the trees, and he could have laughed at the bunches of human fruit clustering in the tops. Then, being Tahitian-born, he doubled his body at the waist, clasped the trunk of his tree with his hands, pressed the soles of his feet against the near surface of the trunk, and began to walk up the tree. At the top he found 2 women. 2 children, and a man. 1 little girl clasped a house cat in her arms. From his eyrie he waved his hand to Captain Lynch, and that doughty patriarch waved back. Raoul was appalled at the sky. It had approached much nearer, in fact, it seemed just over his head, and it had turned from lead to black. Many people were still on the ground grouped about the bases of the trees and holding on. Several such clusters were praying, and in one the Mormon missionary was exhorting. A weird sound, rhythmical, faint as the faintest chirp of a far cricket, enduring but for a moment, but in the moment suggesting to him vaguely the thought of heaven and celestial music, came to his ear. He glanced about him and saw, at the base of another tree, a large cluster of people holding on by ropes, and by one another. He could see their faces working, and their lips moving in unison. No sound came to him, but he knew that they were singing hymns. Still the wind continued to blow harder. By no conscious process could he measure it, for it had long since passed beyond all his experience of wind. But he knew somehow, nevertheless, that it was blowing harder. Not far away a tree was uprooted, flinging its load of human beings to the ground. A sea washed across the strip of sand, and they were gone. Things were happening quickly. He saw a brown shoulder and a black head silhouetted against the churning white of the lagoon. The next instant that too had vanished. Other trees were going, falling and crisscrossing like matches. He was amazed at the power of the wind. His own tree was swaying perilously. One woman was wailing and clutching the little girl, who in turn still hung on to the cat. The man, holding the other child, touched Raoul's arm and pointed. He looked and saw the Mormon church careering drunkenly 100 feet away. It had been torn from its foundations, and wind and sea were heaving and shoving it toward the lagoon. A frightful wall of water caught it, tilted it, and flung it against half a dozen coconut trees. The bunches of human fruit fell like ripe coconuts. The subsiding wave showed them on the ground, some lying motionless, others squirming and writhing. They reminded him strangely of ants. He was not shocked. He had risen above horror. Quite as a matter of course he noted the succeeding wave sweep the sand clean of the human wreckage. A third wave, more colossal than any he had yet seen, hurled the church into the lagoon, where it floated off into the obscurity to leeward, half submerged, reminding him for all the world of a Noah's Ark. He looked for Captain Lynch's house, and was surprised to find it gone. Things certainly were happening quickly. He noticed that many of the people in the trees that still held had descended to the ground. The wind had yet again increased. His own tree showed that. It no longer swayed or bent over and back. Instead, it remained practically stationary, curved in a rigid angle from the wind and merely vibrating. But the vibration was sickening. It was like that of a tuning fork, or the tongue of a Jew's harp. It was the rapidity of the vibration that made it so bad. Even though its roots held, it could not stand the strain for long. Something would have to break. Ah, there was one that had gone. He had not seen it go, but there it stood, the remnant, broken off halfway up the trunk. One did not know what happened, unless he saw it. The mere crashing of trees and wails of human despair occupied no place in that mighty volume of sound. He chanced to be looking in Captain Lynch's direction when it happened. He saw the trunk of the tree, halfway up, splinter and part without noise. The head of the tree, with three sailors of the Aorai, and the old captain sailed off over the lagoon. It did not fall to the ground, but drove through the air like a piece of chaff. For 100 yards he followed its flight, when it struck the water. He strained his eyes, and was sure that he saw Captain Lynch wave farewell. Raoul did not wait for anything more. He touched the native and made signs to descend to the ground. The man was willing, but his women were paralyzed from terror, and he elected to remain with them. Raoul passed his rope around the tree and slid down. A rush of salt water went over his head. He held his breath and clung desperately to the rope. The water subsided, and in the shelter of the trunk he breathed once more. He fastened the rope more securely, and then was put under by another sea. One of the women slid down and joined him, the native remaining by the other woman, the two children, and the cat. The supercargo had noticed how the groups clinging at the bases of the other trees continually diminished. Now he saw the process work out alongside him. It required all his strength to hold on, and the woman who had joined him was growing weaker. Each time he emerged from a sea he was surprised to find himself still there, and next, surprised to find the woman still there. At last he emerged to find himself alone. He looked up. The top of the tree had gone as well. At half its original height, a splintered end vibrated. He was safe. The roots still held, while the tree had been shorn of its windage. He began to climb up. He was so weak that he went slowly, and sea after sea caught him before he was above them. Then he tied himself to the trunk and stiffened his soul to face the night and he knew not what. He felt very lonely in the darkness. At times it seemed to him that it was the end of the world and that he was the last one left alive. Still the wind increased. Hour after hour it increased. By what he calculated was 11 o'clock, the wind had become unbelievable. It was a horrible, monstrous thing, a screaming fury, a wall that smote and passed on, but that continued to smite and pass on, a wall without end. It seemed to him that he had become light and ethereal, that it was he that was in motion, that he was being driven with inconceivable velocity through unending solidness. The wind was no longer air in motion. It had become substantial as water or quicksilver. He had a feeling that he could reach into it and tear it out in chunks as one might do with the meat in the carcass of a steer, that he could seize hold of the wind and hang on to it as a man might hang on to the face of a cliff. The wind strangled him. He could not face it and breathe, for it rushed in through his mouth and nostrils, distending his lungs like bladders. At such moments it seemed to him that his body was being packed and swollen with solid earth. Only by pressing his lips to the trunk of the tree could he breathe. Also, the ceaseless impact of the wind exhausted him. Body and brain became wearied. He no longer observed, no longer thought, and was but semi-conscious. One idea constituted his consciousness. So this was a hurricane. That one idea persisted irregularly. It was like a feeble flame that flickered occasionally. From a state of stupor he would return to it, so this was a hurricane. Then he would go off into another stupor. The height of the hurricane endured from 11 at night till 3 in the morning, and it was at 11 that the tree in which clung Mapai and his women snapped off. Mapai rose to the surface of the lagoon, still clutching his daughter Ngakura. Only a South Sea Islander could have lived in such a driving smother. The pandanus tree, to which he attached himself, turned over and over in the froth and churn, and it was only by holding on at times and waiting, and at other times shifting his grips rapidly, that he was able to get his head and Gakura's to the surface at intervals sufficiently near together to keep the breath in them. But the air was mostly water, what with flying spray and sheeted rain that poured along at right angles to the perpendicular. It was 10 miles across the lagoon to the farther ring of sand. Here, tossing tree trunks, timbers, wrecks of cutters, and wreckage of houses, killed 9 out of 10 of the miserable beings who survived the passage of the lagoon. Half drowned, exhausted, they were hurled into this mad mortar of the elements, and battered into formless flesh. But Mapai was fortunate. His chance was the 1 in 10. It fell to him by the freakage of fate. He emerged upon the sand, bleeding from a score of wounds. Gakura's left arm was broken, the fingers of her right hand were crushed, and cheek and forehead were laid open to the bone. He clutched a tree that yet stood, and clung on, holding the girl and sobbing for air, while the waters of the lagoon washed by knee-high, and at times waist-high. At 3 in the morning the backbone of the hurricane broke. By 5 no more than a stiff breeze was blowing, and by 6 it was dead calm and the sun was shining. The sea had gone down. On the yet restless edge of the lagoon, Mapuhi saw the broken bodies of those that had failed in the landing. Undoubtedly Tafara and Norai were among them. He went along the beach examining them, and came upon his wife, lying half in and half out of the water. He sat down and wept, making harsh animal noises after the manner of primitive grief. Then she stirred uneasily, and groaned. He looked more closely. Not only was she alive, but she was uninjured. She was merely sleeping. Hers also had been the 1 chance in 10. Of the 1,200 alive the night before, but 300 remained. The Mormon missionary and a gendarme made the census. The lagoon was cluttered with corpses. Not a house nor a hut was standing. In the whole atoll not 2 stones remained one upon another. One in 50 of the coconut palms still stood, and they were eggs, while on not one of them remained a single nut. There was no fresh water. The shallow wells, that caught the surface seepage of the rain, were filled with salt. Out of the lagoon a few soaked bags of flour were recovered. The survivors cut the hearts out of the fallen coconut trees and ate them. Here and there they crawled in two tiny hutches, made by hollowing out the sand, and covering over with fragments of metal roofing. The missionary made a crude still, but he could not distill water for 300 persons. By the end of the second day, Raoul, taking a bath in the lagoon, discovered that his thirst was somewhat relieved. He cried out the news, and thereupon 300 men, women, and children could have been seen, standing up to their necks, in the lagoon and trying, to drink water in through their skins. Their dead floated about them, or were stepped upon where they still lay upon the bottom. On the third day the people buried their dead, and sat down to wait for the rescue steamers. In the meantime, Nori, torn from her family by the hurricane, had been swept. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.